Hello there, and welcome to the Route to Networking podcast brought to you by Hamilton Barnes. Here at Hamilton Barnes, we're a specialist in recruitment consultancy in the technology space, covering everything from enterprise networking, telecoms, security, fiber, and more.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Route to Networking podcast. I'm James Dean, the VP of Network Engineering here at Hamilton Barnes. Today, I'd like to introduce a very special guest, Jessica Zucker, who is the Director of Online Safety Policy at Ofcom. Jessica's had an incredible career in the cybersecurity and policy space, including previous roles at both Microsoft and Meta. Can't wait to hear more about Jessica's journey today. So I'd like to start off by saying welcome to the podcast, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me, James. I'm so excited to be part of this conversation right now.
No, I really appreciate you coming on there. Yeah, it's been kind of in the pipeline for a while now, so I really appreciate you taking the time out today. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Recently got back from a three-week holiday in the US and Mexico. Not loving the weather here, but it's certainly getting better every day.
Yeah, where in the US did you travel?
So I'm from San Diego, so I spent some time there. My sister lives in San Francisco, so I went to go visit her and went to a little island called Holbox near the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico.
Okay, now back to sunny London.
Exactly.
Well, perfect. But one place we'd always like to start on the podcast is just to get a little bit more of a background about your career up to now and how you kind of got to where you are today as the Director of Online Safety Policy at Ofcom.
Yeah, sure. So I'll tell you a little bit about my journey. It's pretty nonlinear and has taken many different unexpected turns, but I hope that that will provide some useful lessons for people who are interested in pursuing a career in the space. So as you mentioned, James, I'm the Director of Online Safety Policy at Ofcom. For those of you who don't know what Ofcom is the UK's communications regulator, so responsible for regulating TV, broadband, spectrum, online safety, post, basically like the communications sectors in the UK. I will say my job in a very high level form, and then we can delve into that later. But at the highest level, my job is to ensure that tech companies that operate in the UK are making their platform safe for users online. And I come to this space as an expert in what we call sort of the trust and safety field, which is a niche part of the tech sector that relates to the policies, the processes, and the products that can improve users' trust and safety in the platforms that they operate on. And I think, like a lot of people who end up in this field of trust and safety, I took a very nonlinear path. I had actually aspired to work in foreign policy in the US, but then took a different turn after a very strange film called The Interview, a satirical piece by Seth Rogen came into my life, and we'll get into that later. But I promise there's a connection there with my career journey. but if it's okay with you, James, I can start kind of at the like where I started with foreign policy and then how I made that move into tech.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Perfect.
So I loved foreign policy. I thought that was going to be my career path. After I finished my bachelor's degree at the University of Miami, I moved to South Korea and I did a Fulbright scholarship. And so I spent a couple years there, which is actually where my mother grew up. And I taught English in rural parts of the country. I set up an educational nonprofit organization. I volunteered with North Korean defectors and did some policy research for the U.S. Forces Korea, which is like the U.S. Yeah. Department of Defense's base there. And that was what I was really super interested in, is this like aspect of foreign policy and East Asian military security. So when I was doing this work and I was living in Korea at the time, North Korea was actually suspected of launching a cyber attack that targeted South Korean media and financial institutions. And for me, this was sort of a wake up call. I just hadn't been thinking about national security when it comes to the digital space. Mm-hmm. And that also happened to be kind of the areas where there was more hiring happening. So strategically, I was thinking, okay, if this is where there's hiring and opportunities, maybe I can pair my interest in like national security, foreign policy with this emerging technology angle, but genuinely didn't really know very much more than a vague interest.
Quick question on that.
Yeah.
What was your, because you mentioned growing up, you were a lot more interested in foreign policy. Why do you think that was? Was it because your family heritage or?
Probably a bit of that. I mean, I'm from a quite mixed background. So I grew up in the US, but my mom grew up in South Korea. My dad grew up in the US, but his family is from Eastern Europe. And I think like heritage, culture, you know, growing up with like multiple religions in the household always just kind of had a big interest for me. But I remember in high school, I think it was my senior year in high school, I think we had a school speaker come in to talk about his life, and he had grown up in apartheid in South Africa and written this memoir. And I remember reading it and just thinking, you know, how did I go all throughout high school and middle school and not even know what apartheid was? And it just kind of like blew my mind about all these things that were happening in the world in terms of human rights violations and international law implications. And I just was endlessly fascinated by it and wanted to just, you know, get out of the US, travel, like learn more about other places of the world.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's it's funny because most like teenagers have very little interest in that kind of thing. So it's pretty awesome. And sorry, I interjected there. So then you started looking into the cyberspace after the cyber attack.
Yeah. So generally interested in national security, tech, North Korea stuff, didn't really know what to do with all that. I ended up going to Harvard to do my master's degree in public policy. And that's kind of where I was trying to figure out how to put all these pieces together of things that I was vaguely interested in. And that's actually where the Seth Rogen movie comes back in. Because when I was at Harvard, as you may remember, Sony Pictures released this movie called The Interview, which basically depicts Seth Rogen and James Franco going to North Korea to assassinate Kim Jong-un. And that movie really angered the North Korean leadership. And allegedly, they responded with launching a cyber attack at Sony Pictures. And so while this was happening, I had kind of on a whim applied for an internship at the State Department's newly established cyber policy office. And so when this happened, that team, which had just been sort of stood up, you know, kind of quickly shifted its priority focus to North Korean cybersecurity issues. And so it was just a very random me being at the right place at the right time. They had never had an intern before. I'm guessing they had never expected to have someone who specialized in North Korean cybersecurity. So I just had a really great opportunity to work there during my summer between my grad school first year and second years. Ended up working on like quite niche policy issues related to export controls, which I won't bore you on. But the thing that was really significant for me with working on this was that I was having to interface a lot with people in the tech industry and helping the tech industry was trying to help the U.S. policymakers, like the people I was working with at the State Department, understand the impact of this like particular policy. And I realized personally just how little I understood the technologies and how important this would be if I was going to be a policymaker in this space. So I decided to sort of defer my future in public service. And instead, after leaving Harvard, I decided to go into tech. So I moved to Seattle and started working for Microsoft and was able to work on just really interesting things, basically a continuation of my master's thesis. So I was focusing on how nation states weaponize tech infrastructure and the role that tech companies play in sort of digital warfare, which, you know, so fascinating for me at the time. So I spent a few years in Seattle, eventually moved with Microsoft to Brussels, which is their European headquarters. And when I moved to Europe, I got sort of even deeper into this space, you know, cybersecurity, election interference, and increasingly disinformation. And I think on the latter point, the issues around disinformation, particularly, you know, following the 2016 US presidential election, I found to be endlessly difficult and fascinating. And I kind of just wanted to be in the heart of the storm. It was, you know, the center of debate in so many different places. And I wanted to be part of shaping that conversation. So that's what kind of prompted me to leave Microsoft and move to London, start working for Facebook, which, as you know, is now Meta. And so when I was at Meta for a few years, I led their misinformation policy team for the Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and was the global health misinformation policy lead during the COVID pandemic, which meant I didn't get loads of sleep. Pretty stressful job.
So that was if you'd see it on Facebook or Instagram quite a lot, where someone would put a post up and then it would say at the bottom, this is misinformation. So you did like the back end of that.
Yeah, that was part of my job. So like in short, like my job there was to write the rules for what is and is not allowed to be posted on Facebook and Instagram, you know, related to misinformation. And we would write these rules and then we would work with the product managers, the engineers, the operations teams to then set up this global infrastructure that could enforce those rules at scale. And so this meant that the work was just unbelievably intellectually challenging and meaningful. We were frontline decision making on issues around the COVID-19 pandemic, the invasion of Ukraine, the coup in Myanmar, the civil war in Ethiopia, January 6th. It was an incredibly meaningful opportunity and I learned so much. But after doing that role for a few years, Ofcom kind of randomly just came knocking on my door. I wasn't necessarily looking to leave. Eventually, I had many really interesting conversations with them about what they were doing. And they basically offered me the opportunity to continue working on this mission of, trying to keep people safe online. But rather than doing it from one super big platform, being able to do it for an entire industry. And that was really what convinced me to join.
That's one hell of a story that if Seth Rogen didn't make the interview film, you might not even be where you are today. It's like the butterfly
effect. Yeah, who knows?
It's like the stars aligned perfectly for all of those opportunities, like you said, with your specialities in Korean politics as well. That is awesome. So where have you lived throughout your career? So you've done the US, London, Belgium.
Yeah. Korea. So San Diego, Miami. I did study abroad in London and Seoul. And then I moved to Gwangju, which is in the southern part of Korea. And then Jeju, which is an island off the southern coast of Korea. And then Boston, then Seattle, then Brussels, then London.
You move around a lot then. That's awesome. And one thing that is like a common theme in the podcast and when interviewing guests is the impact that throughout their career journey, that mentorship has throughout their career. How do you think that's impacted you throughout your time, whether up to now or at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with your previous guests. I think without a doubt, mentorship has played an enormous role in my career. And I feel endlessly grateful for the people that have played various mentorship roles. I've had, some mentors, I would say, who I would put in more like formal category where we've maintained really regular communications and there's like a clear, I'm coming to you for advice and that kind of relationship. And they tend to help me make really big decisions on, career changes or job opportunities and things like that. And I'm happy to share more about one of my mentors who's really helped my career a lot. I think there's also other people who probably wouldn't consider themselves mentors to me, but without them realizing that they made a huge impact on me and in my own learning and career development. I also kind of look at like peers and friends as another form of mentorship. And this is where you can get really great tactical advice, like, you should do this research opportunity or this teaching assistant role, because then you'll get a relationship with this very important professor who otherwise won't have time to help you, like those kinds of things that have been super genuinely game changers for my career. But I also think one thing that we, I think people tend to forget about is the importance of reverse mentors. So a lot of the people that I've managed have been unbelievably helpful for me in learning and growing as a people manager and helping me understand how I can improve and things that I might be missing. So I think of mentorship kind of in those four big buckets, and each, you know, in each of those, I've had people who've made a big difference to my journey. But yeah, I'm happy to share more about any of them.
Yeah, I love the idea of reverse mentoring.
It's not
a phrase I've heard before, but it makes sense. Like, you know, I manage a team here, so asking them for feedback or just self-reflection. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm definitely going to use that again in the future. Are there any particular standouts on the mentoring front?
Yeah, I think probably one of the most important mentorship relationships I've had in my career is with General David Petraeus, who has been my mentor for about the last decade. So General Petraeus, I was his research assistant when I was at Harvard, and I spent dozens of hours interviewing him about his time leading the multinational forces in Iraq, serving as the commander of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And as you'll probably recall, he was also the director of the Central Intelligence Agency in the U.S. And this work that I did with him, basically it culminated in a series of video interviews with him about his four big ideas for strategic leadership, which really created the basis for the way that I think about leading at scale. And since that opportunity to be his research assistant, General Petraeus and I have stayed in touch for, you know, like I said, about a decade now. And he's provided me with a huge amount of strategic advice. Anytime I've been thinking about making a big career change, he consistently offers me different perspectives, asks me really hard questions. He's a sounding board for my questions, in particular when I was trying to decide whether to take the role at Ofcom and make this big, you know, jump from tech sector to public sector. He was incredibly helpful and you know, just helping me think through what the public service would give me and just how important these kinds of opportunities and roles are for these bigger questions that we're dealing with in society. So he's certainly somebody who's played a huge role in my career.
That's one hell of a mentor as well. The accolade, that's awesome. With somebody listening now, say, and they don't have a mentor, or they want to get a mentor, or something they've been thinking about, how have you personally approached it? Has that been just through natural progression or like natural conversations, or have you intentionally gone out and seeked mentors, or both?
I think it's been a little bit of both. I tend to not do the very formal asking somebody to be your mentor. Like many relationships, it's best when it starts from sort of an organic place where there's a genuine interest in somebody's work or an admiration in their career. And what I found is that trying to approach mentorship as a two-way street is really important to developing that relationship, where it's not just an extractive, I'm coming to you for something that I need, but I'm also going to give you something in return. And one way that I've tried to do that when I have conversations with General Petraeus or other mentors is, their time is so valuable, and I want to make sure that they understand that I'm actually using their advice. And so anytime I'm in touch, I'm saying, you know, here are, last time we talked, we discussed XYZ thing and you suggested I try this. So this is how I used your advice. This is what happened and this is what I took from it. And so I think it's really helpful for people who are mentoring to see, you know, where their work, you know, where their advice is going. And it helps create that feedback loop where it becomes that two-way street. But generally, I think taking on these kinds of things, like I've done research assistantship in grad school programs, becoming a teaching assistant, having relationships with your skip level boss or people who are senior in other parts of your organization where you have something that you can kind of relate to on. That's sort of how I've approached it.
Yeah, I guess the exchange of value is important rather than the feedback loop part is really important. I'm thinking now when I've had people come to me for advice, and after a while, I guess you just could come across like you're either complaining a lot or just always just seeking, just trying to take. So there's a good book, I don't know if you've read it, The 80-20 Principle.
I haven't, but I've heard it's a great book.
Yeah, so one of the things they talk about in there, though, is having, like, say, for every two people you have mentor you, you have two peers within your network, and then you have two, like, mentees, because then you can appreciate the value exchange that goes upwardly, downwardly. So you having people come to you for mentorship means you'll become a better mentee and vice versa.
Absolutely.
Enjoying the conversation so far? Interested in following a similar career path? Why don't you take a look at our jobs page, where you'll find your next opportunity. Head to www.hamilton-barnes.com/jobs.
What have been some of the kind of biggest challenges that you've faced during your career, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, so I think something that I, you know, totally honestly, I really struggled with very early on in my career, like frankly, I think a lot of young women do, is imposter syndrome. For me, I think this really stemmed from often being one of the youngest people in the room in my career. So I mentioned before, my mom is Korean, and I spent the early part of my career living in South Korea, where there is quite a strong culture of deference based on age. And this also translates to a lot of very strict hierarchies in the professional sense. And often those hierarchies translate to like sort of age as well. And having grown up with Korean culture and having spent so many formative years in Korea, I had quite a lot of hardwiring that was telling me to be differential to people who are older than me. But in a workplace setting, when basically every single person I worked with or was around me was older than me, it meant that I was really losing my own voice, frankly. And it took me a lot of time, I think, to trust my instincts, to realize that I am an expert, that I am good at my job, and that I don't need to be deferential to people just because they are older than me. And I don't have an easy fix to share for how I overcame that. But it's genuinely something that I think about every day. I push myself in every meeting that I'm in where I, you know, sort of feel nervous to speak up, or if there's like a big public speaking thing or, you know, a high importance meeting with people. You know, I'm trying to push myself to be outside of my comfort zone and to kind of get past that imposter syndrome. And so taking on opportunities that scare me and pushing myself out of my comfort zone has really helped me, because I also think that to some extent, I don't fully want that part of me to go away, because I think it's the part of me that pushes me to keep this, you know, constant learning and improvement mentality as like such an important part of the way that I approach work. I'm always thinking about how can I learn and grow and improve. And that part of it, I do think stems back to that, you know, initial sort of insecurity with my age and not thinking that I had something important to say, but it's now not inhibiting me. And it is now something that I've been able to like overcome in the sense that I trust my instincts and I have a lot of confidence in my ability to deliver.
I know you mentioned you couldn't explain the exact journey, how you've gone from A to B, but was that like, did one day you just wake up and say, you know, I'm going to start speaking up more? Or was that just gradually, as you started compounding more evidence that, you know, that's kind of debunks your imposter syndrome, you kind of chipped away at it? What did that look like?
Yeah, I think a bit of the latter. You know, over time, like long period of time, you know, just having an instinct about what the right thing is to do and having that be validated and realizing more and more that my instincts are right, that I actually do know the answers, that I do have something to say. And it doesn't make a difference that I'm a decade younger than everyone else around me. I can still have an opinion, that opinion can still be right. And I think it just took me a while of like seeing a lot of examples of that and testing that for me to really embrace and trust that.
And what was the reaction like from like the people upwardly, because obviously you're going against technically the social norm? Was there any resistance? Did you have any kind of problems there?
I wouldn't say resistance or problems, but something that I was very acutely aware of was how important it was for me to build bilateral relationships with people. And I really had a big focus, particularly early in my career, on like what I call building up my informal authority. So when you don't have a very senior title that corresponds to having a certain level of formal authority, I focused a lot on how I could build my informal authority within an organization. And that tended to be through, you know, being available a lot of the times, working really, really hard, doing things very well with extreme precision. I was always sort of being willing to take on things that other people might not want to do and think of it as a learning opportunity. And I think that that helped me a lot with developing relationships with people who are more senior in organization. And as they got to know me better, I think that there became more trust. And then I started to feel more comfortable in, you know, voicing my opinions, pushing back on areas where I felt like I could, you know, make a strategic point on, for example.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's something that a lot of people, I'm generalizing here, but generationally, I know a lot of young people coming in now think that, you know, 2 years in, there's a lot of jokes about Gen Zs, just want Gen Zs want to get the promotion, But I love how you intentionally mapped out what you need to be doing to kind of build those relationships and work on that. And then people reciprocate what you do for them, right? And then when you're in those meetings, once you've helped X, Y, and Z person out, they'll want to support you more. And that's incredible. Where did you get that idea from to do that?
So I took this course at Harvard called Exercising Leadership with Ron Heifetz, who's a famous professor there. And he wrote a book called Leadership on the Line. And it there's many, many very interesting things that he teaches, and that's in his book. But that was one of the things that really stuck with me, is this understanding of informal authority versus formal authority, how those things interact and how you can build up one, and how you really can't have one without the other. So that, I think, was probably, you know, very academically was where I learned it. But then in my like early career days, that was where I was trying to test it out and apply it.
Yeah. Okay. So what was that called again? Sorry. Leadership on the Line.
Yeah, that was the book, and the professor's Ron Heifetz.
I love reading, so I'll check that out after. Thank you. And you mentioned about the early kind of struggles as such with your imposter syndrome, but outside of that, being a woman in a male-dominated industry, did you feel that created any hurdles, you know, with gender biases, or if so, how did you navigate those?
Yeah, so I actually feel like for most of my career, I've been fairly fortunate in that I've been surrounded by a lot of women, or teams have been very gender balanced, some skewed like even more heavily towards women. For example, at Ofcom right now, my boss, Jill Whitehead, is a woman, and the chief executive of Ofcom is Melanie Dawes, another woman, and both are super, super committed to empowering women and other minority voices. And in our diversity and inclusion report last year, actually, we found that 54% of our total workforce is women, which is great.
Wow.
So I think my, you know, my current experience and some of my more recent experiences, there has been quite a lot of incredible women around me, but that hasn't always been the case. And I think, you know, as I mentioned before, particularly earlier on in my career, being both young Korean American and a woman, it was just, I felt like there was no one around me that looked like me at all.
Yeah.
And that was quite jarring. It really impacted my confidence. But just kind of like going back to the role of mentors and, you know, people who maybe didn't realize that they were mentoring me. There was one person, I think, in particular, who made a really big difference to me in this regard, and has taught me a lot about how to help empower women in the workplace. And that's another sort of heavy hitter of U.S. national security. And her name is Ambassador Wendy Sherman. I had an unbelievable opportunity to be able to work with her for a little while. And she probably has no idea how much she helped me in overcoming some of these issues around gender in the workplace. But So for those of you who maybe don't know Ambassador Sherman, she is a senior diplomat and a former social worker. So she has a very interesting background. She led the U.S. negotiations for the Iranian nuclear deal and was most recently the Deputy Secretary of State under the Biden administration. She recently retired. And whenever I was in a meeting with Ambassador Sherman, I was always the most junior person there and almost always there because I was taking the notes. That's just how it worked. But nevertheless, Ambassador Sherman, and she knew I was the most junior person there and there to take notes. She would consistently make a point to ask me my views on whatever substance was being discussed in a meeting. She would, no matter what the topic was, no matter how senior the other people were in the meeting, she would always ask me, what did I think? And then she would always do this incredible thing where she would build on what I said or consistently refer back to something I had said to give me credit and to like voice my name in these meetings. And so she would say things like, you know, as Jessica said, blah, 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 or building off the great point that Jessica said, or what you just said sounds really familiar to something Jessica said earlier. And I know these are really small things, but they made an enormous difference to me in terms of my own confidence. You know, she made me feel seen and heard. And that was just unbelievably helpful for me. And she also has a book. It's her autobiography called Not for the Faint of Heart. And she actually shares several anecdotes about this and why she does this. And turns out that she'd be in these meetings with other senior members of the Obama administration, and her and some of the other women in these meetings would realize that their ideas were being repeated by male colleagues as if those colleagues had been the ones to like come up with those ideas. And so whenever this would happen, she and these other women would always make a point to thank that person for reinforcing the idea that a female colleague had already offered. And so again, like really small behaviors in meetings, but it makes a huge difference. It made a big difference to me, but it's also something that I try to be really mindful of doing as well in my position and thinking about how I can empower women and other minority voices and bring them into rooms, you know, whenever I can.
So I read Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. Mm-hmm. And there's certain concepts like when you were saying earlier about the imposter syndrome, it's something obviously I was never aware of being a man. I don't know what imposter syndrome is, but I mean in the context she talks about in the book. And one thing, as soon as I read it, I noticed if I'm in a training room and say there's 10 people, 5 women, 5 men, unless probed, the women would never put their hand up. They would never offer, you know, a voice or an idea to anything. And that was an eye opener for me as well. And I've once reading the book, I noticed that a lot more when you'd be in a meeting. I don't know, Maddie would say something under her breath with like lacking confidence. Jack would then say it big and bullshy, and then everyone, oh, great idea, Jack. And Jack then gets the credit. So yeah, I'll get the other book recommendation off you after as well. So no, I appreciate that. And then moving on to your role now, obviously you kind of touched on it briefly at the start. What does the average day look like for you as director of online safety policy?
It looks different every single day.
You do podcasts.
No, exactly. I'll give you maybe a bit of context, a bit on what the job is. So the United Kingdom recently introduced a set of new laws as part of an online safety act that passed last year. That requires tech companies to take certain actions to protect or prevent the spread of illegal content. So things like hate speech or inciting violence or grooming and child sexual abuse, as well as a set of rules for how to protect children from inappropriate content. So things like porn or things that might promote suicide and self-injury or eating disorders. And so these rules are for the tech platforms to put in place. And my job as a regulator is to make sure that those rules are being implemented, effectively. So my job is sort of split into two buckets at the moment. I lead a few really diverse teams. The first kind of bucket of work that I do is in policy development. So very core to my training and my skills from previous jobs. And as that part of the job, it's to create guidance for the tech industry on the specific steps that they need to take in order to implement these rules. And then the second big part of my role is overseeing the implementation of a video sharing platform regulation that applies a set of rules on preventing illegal content and protecting children to certain video sharing platforms in the UK. So the ones that you will probably have heard of are TikTok and Snap and Twitch, OnlyFans, as well as a few others. And as part of this like secondary bucket of work, it's kind of beyond just policy development. It's strategy, it's transparency, it's a concept that at Ofcom we call supervision, which is maintaining sort of a close relationship with the platforms that you regulate and using sort of soft powers in order to get people to get the platforms to change. Mm-hmm. And last month, if anyone's interested in learning more, we published a report kind of outlining what we've achieved over the last few years in regulating these platforms, what our priorities are, and how we achieve those goals. So how we thought of using our formal powers, our soft powers, you know, our transparency powers to achieve those changes. So as you can tell, my portfolio is really broad and encompasses so many different things. So day to day, it could be something like, you know, since I used to work in this space, reviewing somebody's proposal on best practices for content moderation and giving them substantive input. It might be making a decision about TikTok's compliance with certain online safety rules, or it could be like having to go to Parliament and speak to politicians about foreign interference. But I think that the thing that remains consistent day to day, even though the substance varies really dramatically, is how much time I spend on people management, building like a cohesive team culture, and recruiting. So one of the most impressive things about Ofcom is just how many resources we have to do this job. It's, I think, sort of unprecedented. And whenever I meet with other regulators or policymakers in different countries, their jaw drops when I tell them the number of people that we have at Ofcom working on these issues. So right now we have a cross-functional team of 350 people across Ofcom.
Wow.
For those who can't see, James's eyes just popped out of his head.
I thought he was going to say like 10 or something.
It's remarkable.
I think it's one of the things you don't really... I mean, you were speaking earlier, Sam, about the video platforms and the thought process that goes into it. You wouldn't think that when you're just scrolling through TikTok. You don't realise what's going on behind closed doors to prevent bad things from going on there and whatnot. So, and those 350 people, are they directly, indirectly within your business unit, or is that across the entire kind of policy team? How does that look?
Yeah, it's an entire cross-functional network of people across Ofcom. So this includes people who are specialists in regulation. It's online safety policy specialists, so people who are like very deep in their expertise on like violent extremism, for example. We also have technologists, so people who have, you know, PhDs in machine learning, for example. We have a team of economists, a team of people who look at data and do really great research. We have comms and public policy people. So this entire kind of grouping of skill set we bring together in order to help us implement this online safety regime. So it's a really humbling responsibility to have. I mean, my job, my mission is to make the UK a safer place online. So getting the right people is essential. And the next year, my team is going to be growing pretty significantly. So if anyone who's listening to the podcast is interested, I post on my LinkedIn every week or two all the jobs that we have. We'll be hiring dozens of jobs over the next year. So keep an eye out.
I'll leave your LinkedIn in the footnotes as well.
Thanks.
And within that 350, like, just more about your current kind of day to day, would there be a particular project you're working on, so you might need to have one of the economists on, one of the machine learning, and then you have kind of dotted lines going to you for that project and you spin off another team? And
yeah, that's exactly it. It's super cross-functional. So with whatever we're trying to achieve, it's about bringing together the right groupings of people who have the expertise. And so that often means that for like distinct projects, I will have maybe a couple people from my direct reporting chain who are, you know, maybe policy experts or who specialize in transparency, but then we'll bring in our economist, our tech specialists, our enforcement team, and all of us together will help sort of deliver on a work stream or an outcome.
Okay. And would someone be working on like several projects at one time?
Yeah, I think most people tend to.
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it is. There's that's definitely been one of the things that's been most different in this role for me compared to Meta, where my role at Meta, although, you know, like I said, encompassed a huge range of issues, it was also quite vertical. You know, I was a misinformation specialist, so it could be misinformation in the US or Myanmar, but it was still fundamentally the same type of content issue. Whereas here, yeah, it is compliance, it's hate speech, it's thinking about how do you measure efficacy of age assurance, it's thinking about how do you regulate a company that's as big as Meta versus a two-person startup and a way that's proportionate, and how they might be different in what they can do, and how do you not inadvertently create monopolies through regulation and unintended consequences. So it's just the world of bad things that happen on the internet is so expansive, and that is my job.
Yeah, I'm just thinking like my day plan in the morning is pretty simple, you know, call customers, call candidates. Well, yours is just everything's going on. Loads of different plates spinning. That sounds amazing. So you're at the forefront of the technology with trends and developments that are happening in the space now. Is there anything that you're finding particularly interesting at the moment, or on the other hand, particularly challenging?
I think on the interesting side, like most of my career has been in big tech, and I think particularly when people think about online safety, they probably think about some of the big social media platforms. And, I think that that will continue to be a place where there's a lot of focus for both the companies, but also the regulators. But one of the things I'm finding really intellectually fascinating, as somebody who's spent a lot of time working in this trust and safety space, is how these issues are manifesting in other sectors of tech. So, you know, in dating and gaming and porn and messaging in, online forums, these are all places where online safety issues are also manifesting in these companies now that you have regulations like the one in the UK, the Online Safety Act, or the Digital Service Act in the EU. They all need to start thinking about these things. And so you will now have not just the big social media companies investing loads into their trust and safety organization, but you'll have companies like Hinge and Lego and Pinterest and Epic Games also building up policies and procedures for online safety, and the kinds of challenges that those different sectors will face in this space will probably be slightly different. And I think that there's such an interesting opportunity for people who want to work in this space to be thinking about all these unique sectors and angles that make up this, you know, very diverse tech industry. I think that while I find that to be the most interesting, I think that's also going to be one of the most challenging parts of this space, is that, I think people will always try to say bad things on the internet, and the internet is in many ways a reflection of society. And so, you know, so long that things like hate speech exists offline, I think there will be people who are trying to spread it online. And as companies get better at taking down the bad stuff and going after the bad guys, the bad guys are still there and they're getting more cunning. And so I think one of the big challenges, particularly as a regulator, but also for, you know, the tech platforms, is just being really adaptive. And, the bad actors are going to jump from platform to platform. They will adapt based on how, you know, the tech platforms do, how the regulators, what they focus on. And so we who work in the space of trying to keep people safe, we're going to have to just constantly improve and be adaptive as well.
It must be hard when, say, Facebook would, or Meta would probably be an easier place with the algorithms. You can check misinformation and whatnot else. But unlike you mentioned about video games, if a child's playing FIFA online and somebody's on the headset trying to, I don't know, groom them or whatnot. It must be hard for the business to actually provide online safety for those. I don't know. I'm assuming I'm not that technical, but even on dating apps, I've heard a lot of there's been a big uplift in scammers on dating apps and just dodgy doings going on all the time. So I guess it's a lot more work for you to do, though. A lot more to add to the plate.
And that's part of what our job is to recognize that, you know, the thousands of companies that we're responsible for regulating are going to be very different. And part of what our approach is for the companies themselves to be doing risk assessments and looking at their unique platform and the unique risks that they have, and then taking the appropriate measures that they need to address those risks. And so when we are writing these rules of specific best practices, we're having that in mind, and we're always thinking about proportionality and, you know, tying it back to the specific risk profiles.
So they would have like a best practice almost to then do their own self-assessment and then report that back.
Step, like we want companies to be thinking about their unique risks, to do those risk assessments. And then we've actually just published our first consultation on our rules for how to protect against illegal content. So things I mentioned before, like grooming and child sexual abuse. It's I would say not a light read. It's a whopping, I think, 1700 pages of guidance. But that kind of gives you the sense of the level of detail and the thoughtfulness that we're trying to approach in thinking about the responsibility that we have, but also how wide this industry is.
That's a lot to cover, 1700 pages. But then, like you said, it's no small task. You know, it's important you cover everything off. And for anybody looking to come into the space, the policy space is incredibly specific. But listening to somebody listening now, is any advice you'd give?
I have some. I would say take all of my advice with a grain of salt, because this is stuff that worked for me in my experiences and, you know, might not work for everyone. But a few things I generally try to tell people when they ask me is, you know, we already talked about the role of mentors. I think it's worth repeating just how important mentorship is and finding people that can support your career. I have a mentor who doesn't work in the space that I work in. General Petraeus worked in national security. He's now working in finance, but he still has that strategic vision that can help me in making my career decision. So definitely importance of mentorship. I think secondly, it's sort of a difficult balance, but I think trying to be really mindful of how to balance developing a really deep subject matter expertise in an area while also building up enough generalist skills. That way you can make changes between like policy areas fairly seamlessly is important. So for me, I really deep dived on cybersecurity. And I think that helped me get my foot in the door at Microsoft and then, you know, more broadly into the tech industry. But then learning how to be a good project manager, being able to communicate succinctly to senior people, get up to speed in new areas. Those were the kinds of general skill set that allowed me to very seamlessly transition from cybersecurity to disinformation. Other things, more like practical advice that I like to give people is know when to disagree and commit. You can't fight every single battle, when you do disagree, it's important, I think, for you to make a decision about, is this the hill that I'm willing to die on? And if that is, you know, commit to that. That's something that, you know, I think is really important, is, you know, not going after every battle. I'd say maybe two others that come to mind. I think being really diligent and absorbing feedback is quite important. And this is both in terms of feedback that might be directed to you, but also feedback that you might see being shared with people around you that you could pick up on and learn from. It's, I think, very important, at least in my experience, to not make the same mistake in front of senior people over and over. So having that ability to be self-reflective and to learn and to see every opportunity as a learning one, I think is a great mindset to have. And then the last one is, you know, trust your gut. that has been incredibly important. It takes time, right, to get there, but yeah. That has always, I think, been really important for me.
I love the two points there with the specialist generalist thing. I love the idea that you learn like almost like the softer skills that are scalable and then go inch wide, mile deep. So project management, I imagine leadership would fall into that as well. That's awesome. And then the last part about the feedback, the second from last point, I've never really thought about that, but it makes sense because it just speeds up your learning curve. If you see person next to you makes that mistake, write that down, make sure you don't do that same thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because if you are the manager in that and three people come to you the same mistake in 1 week, the third person, I feel bad for.
Yeah,
that's amazing. And what about personally for you, like the next few years or even beyond that? Is there anything that you have in mind that you're looking to accomplish that you haven't had a chance to explore as of yet?
You know, I feel like I've not been particularly strategic in thinking about what I want to do in like 5-10 years from now. I feel like it's been much more, you know, what's the next year look like. But I've been trying to do a bit more reflecting in this. And I think what I've realized in some of my career conversations with my manager, for example, that, you know, I've spent my entire career almost working in policy in different verticals, different sectors. And that's given me the opportunity to think really deeply about some of these unbelievably difficult societal issues, which we've talked about, you know, trust and democracy and free speech and safety and all this. And in my role now at Ofcom, a big part of what I do is strategy and operations. It's actually not exclusive to policy anymore. And this is where I feel like I'm learning the most. And it's helping me think of policy as like one instrument to achieve broader objectives. And this is something I kind of want to be leaning more into. I don't know what that looks like in practice, but thinking about broader strategy, operationalizing strategies, and leading at scale is sort of where I want to be doing more of. I, again, don't know what that looks like, really practically speaking, but I'm trying to take on opportunities that allow me to do that. And that is probably where I'm going to be spending the next few years thinking about.
Yeah, it sounds as well throughout your career, your kind of level of influence has grown in each role. Obviously Meta was internal to Meta, now you're doing something bigger, and then the next one is to do something even bigger. Is there anything out there, like position or business wise, that does what you're speaking about, or is it still just kind of your brainstorming, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I don't have anything specific. I remember one of my mentors once told me to leave a job when you're not learning anymore, and I'm still learning so much. You know, I feel very much at the edge of my competency, which is exactly where I want to be in a job. And once I don't feel like I'm as challenged or learning in that kind of way anymore, that's when I'll probably start to think about what's next. But again, like I've just kind of always been guided by that, like trying to find interesting things that feel challenging and that I'm learning on a day-to-day basis. And I've not been particularly strategic about, you know, and 5 years I want to be at this position or at this company or anything like that. It's been so much more about just the day-to-day, am I learning or not?
Like you said as well, trust your gut instincts, it's working. Yeah. that was amazing. I really appreciate, you know, the level of detail we've gone into today. I've even got a few book recommendations to take away with me. That's not the end of the kind of formal part of the interview as such, if you can call it formal. The next part is just a quick fire round. So you've got 5 questions here. We call it quick fire. You don't have to just answer the questions quick fire, but we'll start off with just what's your favorite book recommendation and why?
Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. It's a memoir of a psychiatrist of his life in a Nazi death camp and sort of the lessons that he took for spiritual survival. The reason it's my favorite book is it really helped me learn that we can't avoid suffering. And it's about how you choose to cope with suffering and how do you find meaning in it and how you can move forward. So it's something I try to reread this book every year. I often fail, but it's always, you know, every year something that I say I'm going to go back and reread because I find it very grounding.
That is particularly I've been meaning to read this for years, and anyone I speak to suggests it, but I've never read it. But I imagine it's particularly good if something negative happens in your life, kind of puts everything back into perspective to a degree. How old were you when you first read it? So you said you read it, tried to read it yearly. Or how long ago did you offer it?
It was part of the recommended book reading list for that leadership class I mentioned at Harvard. That was when I first read it. So probably a little over a decade now. And I think I've only reread it a few times now, but it's just had such a great impact. You know, this idea that you can only really control your own reaction to a given situation, I think can make, it makes me feel empowered in my ability to have some element of control, even when things feel like they're out of your control.
I didn't realize it was that was kind of the key lesson to it. I'm gonna have to give that a read, because it's like almost stoicism to its core as well. So I'll check that out. And what's your, or if, do you have one, but your morning routine?
I feel like I have a pretty rigorous, like, do the same thing every morning. And it's usually oat milk cappuccino, using a mocha. While the coffee is kicking in, I try to do the hardest work thing, because that's when my brain works the best, is in the early morning. So I do whatever reading or review that is going to be the most intellectually difficult, and then make a smoothie. And I'm very into F45, which is this high intensity interval training. And I do that like 4, 5, 6 times a week sometimes. And that is like the perfect way to get me started on the day.
They look intense. I've seen a few of my friends in it. So you wake up, and then literally within like 10, 15 minutes with your coffee going, you get to work.
Yeah.
Just did that one task.
Yeah, I dive right into work. And then I pause and I exercise, and then I come back to work.
Okay. That's interesting. So a lot of people would do their morning routine, will be journaling and, I don't know, practice gratitude, do loads of stuff before they work. So it's interesting you dive straight into the work. Was there any reason behind you doing that? Did you learn about it online, or?
I just realized that my brain works best in the morning. So when it comes to just doing the difficult thinking stuff of my job, when I have that absolute quiet in the morning, you know, before people are online and pinging me and things are happening, that's where I have this like sort of sacred space where I could just do the thing that's going to require the most of my brain. Cause, you know, as the day goes on, you get more tired. And I try to, I've tried to adapt my calendar in that way. So I do, like, I try to keep a lot of time free in the morning so I could do that, and then do more like meetings and busy tasks later in the day.
Okay. So your deep work will be before lunch, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what's the best piece of advice that you've been given?
I think something along the lines of do things that scare you. I think I've applied this in a lot of different ways in terms of work. You know, I try to push myself to do things that I'm intimidated by, or maybe I feel like will be out of my reach. And generally I can do them, and that, you know, helps give me confidence and helps me take on new opportunities, get new skill sets. But I've also tried to do this outside of work. So you know, this last year I decided to learn how to climb and mountaineer, and with some friends we climbed Mont Blanc and spent a weekend on a glacier, and that scared me to death, but it was an incredible experience. And so, do things that scare you.
So you learn, when did you start doing the mountaineering? Last year?
I started to learn how to rock climb over the summer, and then in October went to Mont Blanc and had a guide, and he helped us learn how to mountaineer.
You really threw yourself into it then.
I did almost no research.
I thought you were going to say you just went bouldering a couple of times or something. That's amazing. Then what's something like an accessory, or just one thing that you couldn't live without?
I mean, I think like in the a physical thing, definitely my mocha and coffee routine is essential for my entire life. But I think on a slightly more like serious practical note, I'd have to say therapy. It's something that I find incredibly important. I treat it like exercise. It's good for you, mind, body, soul, you know, and like focus on self-improvement and self-learning, I think has, it's just one of the most important things in my life. So definitely couldn't live without therapy.
That's amazing. I appreciate your honesty as well. I love the two, therapy and my coffee machine. The two most important things. And what's been the most memorable trip or vacation that you've taken? You've obviously done quite a few. You mentioned four since we spoke.
I wouldn't call this a vacation, but without a doubt, the most memorable trip I took was going to North Korea. And it was maybe 2012 or 2013, I think.
How long was you there?
I went for about a week. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's a very controlled, like scripted trip. You can't go out on your own. You're with minders and you have to go, I think, on the invitation of the Minister of Culture there. So, you know, not you can't see loads of things. You can't explore loads of things. But this is the most closed society in the world. And being able to be there and see it with my own eyes was just eye opening.
Yeah. That is, because even what we see is just what we're allowed to see, what they want us to. That's incredible. How many this isn't on the list of questions. I'm just intrigued. How many countries have you traveled to? So you've lived in quite a few, also.
I have no idea. I haven't counted, but when I was living in South Korea, I traveled kind of all over. And when I used to work for Meta, I mean, I had 1 week where I flew, I think it was 2 weeks, I flew to Johannesburg, Nairobi, Istanbul, and Kyiv. Like, it was just, a lot of travel.
You've had an incredible career in life today, it sounds like that. So I really, really appreciate your time today. It's been, you know, amazing to learn. I've learned a lot about policy. I learned a lot about what I didn't know previously. But I really appreciate all your time and coming on. One thing it's always good to ask is if anybody wanted to reach out, if anybody wanted to connect. We mentioned your LinkedIn earlier, but is there any other social platforms it's worth sharing?
Yeah, LinkedIn is probably the best one. I post pretty regularly about the work that we're doing at Ofcom, but also all the job opportunities. It's tough for me to get through my LinkedIn inbox quickly, but I try to make sure I'm doing it as diligently as I can, because I know that it's helpful for people to connect and want to give back where I can.
You're going to get loads of mentoring requests. I appreciate your time, Jessica. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was great to chat with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on to your podcast.
Thank you.
Hamilton Barnes thanks you for listening to today's episode. Whether you're looking for that next big opportunity or looking for like-minded people to join your team, we'd love to hear from you. So please don't be shy, get in contact. We look forward to hearing from you. Call us on 0207 808 1415 or email us at hello@hamilton-barnes.com.